Okay, call to order the House on Committee on Education for the 23rd of February, 2015. Glad everybody's here. School Board Day. Welcome, school board members. Okay, first of all, we're going to have an introduction of some committee bills. Why don't we do that first?
Okay.
Okay, so I'd like to open a work session on introduction of committee bills.
Chair Daugherty, I move that LC 2706, dated February 20th, 2015, be introduced as 3706, sorry. I move that LC 3706, dated February 20th, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Representative Frederick has moved that LC 3706, dated February 20th, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? And again, I just make the information that doesn't obligate you to vote for it or to like it or to whatever. So anyway, that's going on. Okay, if there's no further discussion, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, it is introduced as a committee bill. Okay, so I close the work session on committee bills, and I open up a public hearing on House Bill 2766.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2766 provides that language-based computer coding may satisfy any world language requirement in public schools and second language requirements in community colleges and post-secondary institutions of education. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, so
that's supposed to be Representative Parrish.
Representative Parrish?
No.
Not here yet. Okay. Why don't we close that one and move on? Was there anyone else who was going to speak on that one? Actually, we're going to close the hearing on 2766. We'll be reopening that. And we open up a public hearing on House Bill 2608.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2608 adds two members to the Oregon Education Investment Board to represent school district boards and parents. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. So we had Morgan Allen and Representative Reardon. Do you defer to Mr. Allen? Okay, actually we have Morgan Allen, Betsy Miller-Jones, and Betty Brown.
Thank you, Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. And House Bill 2608 at this point in time, I think, is really now intended to be a conversation starter about the future shape of the Oregon Education Investment Board or any type of successor board or coordinating council that the legislature's going to be looking at this session. And I think it's important for us to separate the discussion about OEIB from that of the Chief Education Officer, Dr. Nancy Golden. Our members have noted and appreciate her leadership. She's been very collaborative since she's taken the post, and she's done a lot to work to find consensus and opportunities for stakeholders to work together. But in regards to OEIB and the sunset, that is before the legislature, and our Legislative Policy Committee has met and set some parameters for items that they'd like the legislature to continue as that discussion goes forward. The first, which is really what the bill is about today, is that we believe there needs to be appointment of more educators and education stakeholders generally to any kind of statewide board like the OEIB, and our bill specifically appoints a school board member and a parent. This bill, there was a similar bill in the 2013 legislative session. It had bipartisan support. It got 48 votes in the House. It didn't quite make it through the Senate. But you'll notice that the bill also has bipartisan sponsors as well this session. And I think the second thing that our members are looking for, whether it's the OEIB or something else going forward, is that our members don't want that board to have a lot of new broad powers or control over what goes on at the local level. They really want to go back to what I think the original idea was, that we need to focus on creating a seamless P20 education system and look for barriers and places to cut red tape and in bureaucracy. And so I think that's another thing that our folks are looking for. So as you have this, begin to have this conversation today, and all the conversations also occurring in the Senate about the OEIB sunset, OSBA specifically hopes that, again, you look at the overall P20 governance structure. When the legislature created OEIB, there was a lot of talk about getting rid of boards and commissions and redundancies. And I think it would be fair to say that we don't think that goal has quite been met yet. We also think if you're going to create a board or extend the sunset on OEIB, you need to look at creating terms of service for those folks. Like the State Board of Education, you can serve 2 4-year terms. On the OEIB, you're just appointed and serve at the pleasure of the governor. And again, to sort of hammer on the point of today's hearing, House Bill 2608, we really think you need to have more educators and more education stakeholders, specifically the voice of elected school board members and people that represent parents of children in K-12 are missing and critical to that conversation. And I think some people said, well, you get to go to the meetings, you get to express your opinions. And my answer to that is, well, it's quite different to be able to go to a meeting, express your opinions, share your thoughts and concerns, and something completely different to be sitting at that table and have a vote on the actual policy. So that's why we're here today, and I'll turn it over to some folks from OSBA. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Daugherty and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Miller-Jones. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon School Boards Association, and I'm here today to speak in support for the concept in House Bill 2608 of adding a parent representative and a school board member representative to the Oregon Education Investment Board. We want to make sure that parents have a seat and board members have a seat and a vote on the OEIB if the legislature chooses to extend the sunset. With the creation of OEIB, Oregon made a commitment to a continual system of education from birth through college. We believe that is a good concept, a good system. We support it. Our Oregon school board members are in support of that work. But I'll admit that many of our board members also were very skeptical at the beginning of the concept of an Oregon Education Investment Board. They had concerns that this would be just another education program like SimCam, NCLB, that would fail for lack of funding or political will, that this was another fad that would be passing quickly. Too many of them have lived through that, and their concerns were, I believe, justified. We appreciate that the legislature is now going to take a look at the structure and governance of OEIB in the coming weeks. I want to acknowledge that our members have been very impressed with the leadership of Dr. Nancy Golden. As Morgan said, she's been very willing to meet with us, to meet with our members, and to talk about the issues at hand. However, that's not the same as having a seat and a vote on the OEIB. Currently, OEIB is made up of 12 members. They come from various parts of the state and represent many different groups. But to our board members, there's a glaring lack of representation for locally elected school board members and parents. House Bill 2608 proposes adding those two additional board positions, one for a parent, one for a school board, K-12 school board member. As Morgan referred to, a similar bill did pass in 2013 with 48 yes votes. Since the K-12 public education system is the largest item in the state budget and is also the largest piece entity under the authority of the OEIB, it makes sense that a school board member who is ultimately responsible to the state for student achievement, state and federal government for outcomes, and to the local community for producing citizen students who are ready to become citizens of our state, should be a part of those policy decisions being made by the OEIB. So that's why school board members from across the state are asking you to make sure that K-12 board members and parents are represented at the table as voting members of the OEIB. Their insights and a knowledge about how it works, and some of you have been local school board members, knowing what works and what doesn't at the local level will provide a great deal of help in making those important policy decisions and in the debate about how to reach our shared goal of 40-40-20 by 2025. So I hope that you will support this concept of adding a parent and a school board member to the OEIB as we go forward. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Betty Reynolds. I serve on the Oregon School Boards Association Board of Directors, and I also served on two of the Oregon Education Investment Board's advisory committees, and I've attended nearly every one of their meetings for three-plus years now. School boards are committed to the achievement of all students. And it's school boards who enter into achievement compacts with the OEIB, and they govern the outcomes and the measures of progress affecting virtually every aspect of teaching and learning. But we do so without a voice in the policy decisions. And that's why OSBA Board and the Legislative Policy Committee, consisting of about 40 representatives of Oregon's 197 school boards, were unanimous in their support of this proposal. And the proposals were submitted to our membership, and they were overwhelmingly approved. We know that there are separate bills and discussions about the future of the OEIB, and we're very happy to be included in those discussions. And if the OEIB continues, we want to assure that those who are responsible for implementation of the policy decisions of the OEIB school boards have a seat at the table. We thank you very much for your leadership and support of public education and student achievement, and we urge your support of House Bill 2608. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Daugherty. I want to thank you for bringing this forward again. As you said, it did pass before. But I would also, I'm going to ask that, let you understand that I think we should be adding a student, a K-12 student to this. We have a number of K-12 students who serve as student representatives on their respective boards. I know Portland does. I know because I helped start that particular program. But they're also, I think, in Albany and a couple in Beaverton and a few other places have them. And that insight is also extraordinarily important because as adults, we forget a few things. And we're not there on a day-to-day basis to see what takes place. So I want to thank you for bringing this forward. But I'd like to be thinking about how we include students directly in that board and not as... people in the audience making the decisions, but people who are right there as those decisions are being discussed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, comments, Representative?
Well, just comment. I totally support having the OEIB or OEIB school board members on the OEIB. I was a former school board member, and having been married to a school board member, it's just you just can't imagine how much insight that brings you to the operation of the schools and how committed those school board members are. So, and it's still unpaid, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought. So totally support your being on there. I do want to look at who else should be on the OEIB as well. And not really sure is if you put a parent on there, is that kind of double dipping? Because most of the people on there, school, you know, they might be parents. Yeah. I mean, is it How do you define that, parent?
Yeah, so Chair Daugherty, Representative Reardon, I think the way we defined parent was an individual in Oregon who is the parent or guardian of a student who's in our K-12 system, whether that's in a brick-and-mortar school, a virtual school, a charter school, but somebody who has a student actually in the system. And, of course, probably most, if not all, of the OEIB members are parents, but there are organizations. There's the Oregon PTA. There's parent-teacher organizations, Stanford Children, other statewide organizations that specifically bring that parent perspective that we think could be mined for possible people to serve on the board.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this, I don't know if this is really germane to the panel here, but I would like to know, from as far as the OEIB, in people in my district, I have not found, I've found very few people, as a matter of fact, I haven't found anyone who speaks real positively of the OEIB. And now I see two school board, proponents that say, look, we haven't even been on the board, now we'd like to be on the board. I would like Betsy and Debbie, what your view is of the OEIB. You know, if it continues, if it doesn't sunset, you said the school board should be represented along with a parent. But what is your opinion of the way it's worked so far?
I would say that if
you ask our board members directly now, there's a great deal of doubt about its effectiveness. I think the same thing you've been communicated by the people in your community, a lack of understanding of exactly what has been done. It has been a relatively short period of time, and it always takes, when you have an additional, a new organization like this board, time to be effective. And I would say the jury is still out. And no, there is not overwhelming support for what's been done looking backwards, but there is a common agreement that the things that the OEIB was put in place to establish, a seamless PK-20 system, a continuum system of education, school board members support. And this is a model that, done right, relooking at the governance and structure of it, could provide that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. How do you see applications being taken here? How are they promoted, advertised, and how are they taken?
Chair Doherty and Representative Wilson. So we did not change just because this bill we filed before the session, and obviously there's been a lot of changes here in Salem in the last couple of weeks. And so when we originally drafted the bill, we did not tinker with the structure. So currently there's 12 members on the OEIB. This would just increase that to 14.
Right.
And the governor, whoever he or she may be, appoints all of those members, and they're confirmed by the state Senate.
Yeah. Follow up. Yeah, what I'm really getting at is how do potential applicants
Sure.
find out about this, and how are they chosen ultimately?
Sure. Representative Doherty, Representative Wilson, within the bill, there's some language that asks for the governor to consult with our organization and organizations that represent parents for ideas.
Okay.
And certainly if some kind of change like this were made, we would certainly let our members know and encourage them to contact the governor's office and appointments
Great.
And
do
things like that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Those are the only three we had signed up. Is there anyone else to speak on House Bill 2608? Okay, seeing none, I close the hearing on 2608, and I will open up the hearing for House Bill 2766. Representative Parrish. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jean Parrish, House District 37, Westland and Tualatin. And I will apologize. I was supposed to have some students come and testify today on this bill. We sort of had a tragedy over the weekend in my community where we lost two of our kids, and some of those kids were sort of tied to our lobby club, and they are not going to be here today, so I'm flying solo on this. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2766, a bill that would allow coding to meet the world language requirement for our high school graduation and our college admissions. Since being elected to the legislature, this body has been highly engaged in the conversation about how we help schools restore career technical education to Oregon's public schools, recognizing that not every student is on a path that will lead them to a traditional four-year degree. In fact, as part of our aspirational goals of 40-40-20, CTE plays a large role in achieving those benchmarks. Much of the CTE discussion has been focused on restoring mechanical arts like electrical work, auto shop, wood and metal shop, and other hands-on skills programs. In those conversations, challenges like physical infrastructure of old buildings or transportation to regional programs has driven the debates around the cost of restoring CTE to Oregon schools. While CTE certainly encompasses modernized versions of traditional CTE coursework, CTE also includes new technologies that are driving the workforce in our economy. According to Code Oregon, there are currently 700 open jobs that require coding skills. The average salary ranges between $45,000 and $70,000 per year. By 2020, Code Oregon estimates that there will be 10,000 positions that need to be filled, creating an opportunity for Oregon students to move directly from high school into a family wage job. This generation of high school students represents the generation of digital natives. My own children have never known a time in their life when they have not had access to high-speed internet connections, portable devices, and access to a vast world of library of content across the web. I actually had to explain to my children this week what dial-up was. It was referenced in a movie, and they had no idea what that was. And so complete with sound effects, their mother had to explain that to them. Through House Bill 2766, Oregon has a chance to modernize our CTE offerings. House Bill 2766 would allow that coding could meet the world language requirement for graduation and the admissions requirement for our Oregon Institutes of Higher Education. Currently, Oregon's graduation requirement includes 3 credit hours of either world language, art, or CTE. The natural inclination would be to land coding under the CTE offerings, but coding is unique in that it is not only meets the traditional definition of a language, it has symbols, syntax, semantics, and is used for communicators to send and receive messages, but it is truly the only language that is used around the globe. Coders in Pakistan, China, Brazil, Texas, South Africa, and Oregon all use the same underlying language to power the communications we receive across the web, our computers, and our smartphones. House Bill 2766 is easily implemented. Organizations like Code.org have curriculum at the ready. Local companies like Treehouse can deliver coding classes into our classrooms facilitated by a district teacher for $9 per student per month. So for the equivalent cost of an average textbook, we graduate kids who have an immediate workforce skill. When I was in college, a part-time job working through school consisted of waiting tables. With coding skills earned in high school, a student can work part-time during college as they further their skills or find another path. Further, many non-coding jobs are increasingly given preference to candidates with basic coding skills, particularly jobs that require things like managing content for a website, newsletter, or blog. House Bill 2766 isn't an either-or bill. For many students, the option of coding to meet the world language requirement opens up new possibilities. The bill requires Oregon universities to allow coding to meet the admissions requirement, but does not replace the foreign language requirements towards meeting degree requirements at the university. But what House Bill 2766 does do that a traditional foreign language cannot do is provide a CTE that is in high demand and a universal language that will carry a student to a job in another country around the world. House Bill 2766 isn't inventing the wheel. Texas and Oklahoma have already made this choice for their students. Other states that compete with Oregon for tech business like Louisiana and South Carolina are rapidly expanding their code programs in not just high schools, but in middle school as well. Kentucky is on the way to making this a law this year. Oregon, with its Silicon Forest, is not competitive in getting our kids these skills, and very few schools in Oregon have put coding as a CTE offering and made that available to their kids. I will say there's a letter from the Oregon State University that just came out this morning. I was notified this morning about this and potentially being sort of a hardship to them, and they've got some complaints. And I will say it does frustrate me when we get those last minute, I don't like your bill, and no conversation about that. But the reality, like I said, is we are not inventing a new wheel on this, and other states are doing it. So, and actually, some of their arguments in their letter about, you know, what world languages do, actually, coding does meet those objectives. So there's a significant amount of technical expertise that we can draw from in House Bill 4 to implement House Bill 2766. And more importantly, unlike other traditional CTE offerings like welding or mechanics, if a school so chooses, the digital curriculum allows for a student to have self-directed summer learning. So the learning doesn't stop because there's no teacher in the classroom. A child could continue throughout the summer and continue to engage in those skills. There's a lot of web offerings and things that would allow a child to continue that towards learning and being very self-directed. So as a four-year veteran of the House Education Committee, I urge the committee to support House Bill 2766. This is one of the most meaningful and affordable CTE opportunities that we can give our kids. We talk a lot in this building about family wage jobs, and we're all supportive of that. And we know how expensive yet successful traditional CTE is for our kids. So for just a few dollars per student, we can give Oregon kids an opportunity at a real family wage job with unlimited potential for flexibility, future earnings, and the ability to be competitive in the global marketplace. So I will open that up to some questions. I certainly urge your support. I think this is an exciting opportunity. There is also a letter from Dave Porter. Many of us get emails from Dave on a regular basis. And my heart is with him on wanting to expand things like Mandarin language and other language that he is interested in, and seeing how we develop children who are fluent world language speakers. But I have to say, as after taking high school French and college French, nobody's ever asked me for that as a skill in a job, and I'm lucky if I can go into a nice restaurant and read the menu. So that's how much retention I've had after years of taking French class. These are real skills, folks, that we're talking about that actually translate into jobs. And while certainly a kid could come out of high school and get a job right away, I mean, obviously we want them to continue to engage and, you know, go on to a community college or a higher ed path. But this gives them tools along the way, a skill to fall back on, and a language that is universally spoken around the world.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Parrish? Representative Bredow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Parrish, that number 700, I heard also at a meeting prior to the session, and they said that there was a class down at Oregon State, but it was only putting out a very few number of people a year, like 30 a year or something like that, and this 700 was what was in demand right now for jobs up in Portland that paid somewhere around $90,000 a year.
Yeah.
So if that demand is there, if the opportunity is there, if even in this committee we heard earlier that Oregon is putting out I think 1,400 and some teachers, and there's only 450 jobs a year, and so there's a surplus of teachers. It seems like if the market demanded people in this occupation, that the schools would get on board to go ahead and produce those. Is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Bredow, I think you're correct. I philosophically align that way. If we have some demand, what can we be doing in our schools to meet that demand? You know, the interesting thing is the 700 number you heard was somewhere, you know, in Oregon. The beauty about these jobs is that you can live in rural Oregon and work for a company downtown Portland and never have to go in and, I mean, you can interface with the company. And not only are there jobs in Oregon, there are jobs globally, you know, certainly in other states, that you can be a resident of Oregon and be employed elsewhere. You know, we've got a business in my community that actually is in, I don't know if he's met with you yet, Chair Doherty, but a constituent who manages a company in Representative Doherty's district, where they've got 150 of these, you know, kids, and they see where they need some entry-level type coders. He says that the wage is somewhere between $11 and $35 an hour, depending on experience. Kids with skills move up faster. You know, it's a company that could just as easily be in Idaho or Louisiana. They've certainly been approached by other states to leave and go settle somewhere else. So the fact is these are portable skills that don't require people to necessarily leave Oregon. And we see that the demand is just going to continue to increase in Oregon, but not just in Oregon, around the globe. So if we can meet a language requirement, and I'll be honest, I mean, my kid's, his mother cares about education greatly, and some of you heard me say before, just struggles with the traditional schooling, would love to be engaged in a program like this. And to meet that need, he's taken Spanish for a couple years now and really struggles with it. Like, it's not firing for him, but this type of language does fire for him, and it does keep him interested in school. And he could have a skill potentially in the future where he comes out and has a job. So you're right about, we could meet a lot of demand. And this is something that other states are doing, and they're implementing, and they're moving forward with it. And we have an opportunity to get our sort of ducks in a row and be an early adopter rather than be sort of late to the party and have our kids one other area of our skills be falling behind compared to other states.
So the 700 jobs, is that currently what the opening is, or is it a growing need year after year for an additional 700 next year, an additional 700 the next year? Is it an ongoing growth pattern?
Madam Chair, Representative Bredow, right now that's the current need, as I understand it. I got a chance to go out and talk with some folks who are from this company, Treehouse, which is part of Code Oregon and trying to get kids connected to these skills. It is a current need, and they're estimating that the need in just a few short years will be as much as 10,000 as we continue to sort of bring this tech talent here. And, you know, and it's not just like somebody who's coding for the internet. I mean, when you think about the digital animations that's happening at Leica Studios, when you think about sort of all of where this intersects with our lives to communicate and get our messages across, it's prevalent across almost everything we do today. And so that demand is going to continue to go up, and our kids who were born to these devices, you know, they're missing out on an opportunity to understand how the underlying architecture of the web works and the language that goes with that if we don't get curriculum like this into their classes.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Reardon.
I'm
I did co-sponsor this, and I think it's a great idea. I really appreciate Julie bringing it forward for a discussion. But I did have one question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Code Oregon in your letter. If I'm a high school teacher that's a super computer geeky kind of guy, which I'm not, could I also create my own curriculum? Would I go buy a curriculum somewhere? How would that work? It sounds like this is sort of promoting Code Oregon. So are there other ways to develop this kind of a program, or do we have to go through Code Oregon?
Madam Chair,
Code Oregon. I didn't mean Code. Code Oregon.
I know what you mean. Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, no. The bill is totally agnostic of the delivery mechanism. I bring up an organization like that because they are currently working with quite literally 100, Code.org is working with quite literally hundreds of schools across the country, middle schools even, and they have sort of created sort of a turnkey method, but it's free. So just, it doesn't cost us anything to tap into those resources, because they've seen, the folks who are doing this for a living see that there is a truly an unmet need happening in their industry, and instead of waiting for government to sort of respond, they're trying to get as much into the hopper and put the tools out there. So the bill does not reference anybody's curriculum. I'm just giving some examples of some folks who are doing this. It doesn't, there's a very low cost, either, you know, some of the free curriculum that's available, or, you know, sort of the pay per student, more intense support models that are available that are out there, certainly with local companies, and but there's folks outside of our state who are doing this as well. And I think that's really going to be a matter of what each individual school decides based on their own technical expertise that they have in their building. It could be that you've got somebody who's a total, you know, nerd this way, and, you know, who's a science teacher who says, hey, this is right up my alley and I can do this and make this work, totally agnostic of the actual delivery mechanism.
Thank okay, thank you. Any other questions, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think this is great. I think it's a great opportunity. We talk so much about college and career ready, but this is a career that has not been talked about. So I think that's really exciting. One of the things I just wanted to make sure that we clarify, that if I want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly, that this does not change the foreign language degree requirement for higher ed institutions. It merely changes the requirement for entry, correct?
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, that's indeed correct. The goal is not to go into our universities and say that, you know, you've got some liberal arts degree and it requires 2 years of a foreign language, and this is going to substitute or satisfy that. You would still need to go in and take that coursework at the university. This is just for placement and saying, hey, if you took this to meet your world language requirement in school, we're going to open up the door of the university, but it's still incumbent on the student to actually go and, you know, take the additional coursework at the university. And I'll say that, you know, we talk a lot about proficiency in this building, and frankly, having taken foreign language and then gone on to higher ed, I was not proficient with what I got in my high school to go into college and be proficient. So we remediate in a lot of things. We do a lot of remediation, I think, in foreign language as well. So, I mean, I think most people, even if they get a couple years in high school, unless they're really, you know, using it and engaged with it, they're using it in their home as a second language, and they have sort of that support, what they're getting in high school doesn't necessarily translate into proficiency and fluency going into the higher ed. So, you know, that further engagement, certainly when they get there, I think is beneficial. But the reality is you also have a lot of kids who get to language for the first time ever in college, and it's sort of like, you know, the all-day kindergarten for a kid whose family is reading to them at the beginning, the sort of the outcomes are really narrow by the time everybody gets to third grade. We don't see some of those impacts, you know, maybe for lower income kids. And I think that sort of has a parallel in the foreign language. You know, if you're not really using it day to day as a student, your proficiency going into high school or going into college language, I think, is somewhat limited. And we do have some, you know, opportunities where kids have never taken a language and they start in college for the first time. So our goal is not to replace any degree requirement around language.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Representative Parrish.
Thank you.
The other person we have signed up, Debbie Kresge. Oh, and Sebastian, I had a shoot. Was I close?
Pretty much.
Okay, thank you. Adushuki.
Hi, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Debbie Koreski, and I'm the government relations person from Portland State University. And so I'm happy to be in front of the K-12 committee today and not in our other education committee, which is the higher education coordinating committee. And do we have crossover? So I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
They keep the best ones on this committee.
It's true. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think she just called the higher ed committee the B committee. And
yes.
And that you guys were the A committee. Okay. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak with the sponsor of the bill before the bill was heard in front of the committee today. And so we knew that her intent of the bill was to have this apply to the two-year foreign language requirement in high school as you come into. And I think Sebastian will speak to some of our concerns should the bill expand any further than that into any of the degree requirements into our four-year or either our two-year degrees at community colleges or universities, which are especially the universities are the purview of the faculty and along with the Board of Trustees now established at all seven of the universities. So if the intent is to apply to the 2 years coming from high school into a university or a community college, I think that we would need to have a couple amendments to make sure and narrow the bill and make sure that that's where the focus on the bill was. And we'd also need to have a conversation with our faculty, along with probably high school experts, about is that appropriate? About do you want to replace the 2 years of French, German, Spanish, Mandarin, whatever that is, with an optional computer coding option? So, summarize, I want to say that we appreciate that, you know, everyone is focused on how do we fill this gap between what industry is clearly telling us that they need in terms of STEM-related fields, computer science. We know that there's a gap, and how we pull students through our pipeline all the way from kindergarten up through the four-year degrees and even advanced degrees. And the universities have been working in partnership through programs like ETIC and some of our other programs to make sure that we are filling those gaps. But we hear it every day in the Workforce Committee and the Higher Ed Committee. I'm sure you hear it in the K-12 Committee. It is a challenge. The math and science and the STEM-related fields are expensive. The CTE-related fields are expensive, and they require students to, you know, really be prepped and ready to come into these advanced-level courses in the universities and the community colleges. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions after Sebastian.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sebastian Hajduszke. I am a faculty member at Oregon State University. I am a professor of German. I'm also the current coordinator of World Languages and Cultures at Oregon State University. And I should also mention that co-signers to my comment are Professor of Computer Science Michael Bailey. He's also the Faculty Senate President, and the Vice Provost of Academic Affairs. That's Rebecca Warner. My comments today are largely based on the fact that we question the nature of computer coding as a world language. This goes back to the linguistics of the field that I and my colleagues teach. We do more than send out a series of commands to a computer. We talk about culture, we talk about history, we teach our students to appreciate other ethnicities. We do more than what computer coding does. If you have taken a foreign language before, you probably know that you are supposed to learn how to speak, to read, to write, and to listen and to make sense of what you hear. So computer coding does very little of that. We learn how to code, how to write, and how to send information to a computer. We as faculty, and like I said, not only the faculty in the humanities, but also the faculty in the sciences, believe that world languages is not fulfilled by computer coding. Now, we all agree that computer coding is essential in this day and age, But we believe that the House Bill 2766 and the World Languages requirement should not be fulfilled by computer coding because it teaches none of the skills that we think a student in this day and age needs to be not only proficient but also successful in our international world. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my daughter takes sign language as her requirement for the world language. What in your, tell me how you feel about sign language versus the computer coding, because sign language, well, tell me what you think.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. This is an excellent question. American Sign Language, I believe, is also in one of the previous bills, was added as, I don't want to say as a special case, but as something that we recognized is a language that we need to be taught so we can communicate with members of our communities. This is not different from other languages. Farm workers who speak Spanish, for example. The I think American Sign Language teaches all of the skills that other languages do too. There's one exception, and this is that the oral component is replaced by the hand gestures, the hand motions, and the lip movements.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So there's no writing, though, involved. There's not really a lot of cultural pieces that are involved. She's been taking it for several years, so I can speak from experience with her. There might be a little bit of cultural. The ethnicity piece is not there, but she's had an amazing experience with that. We have an autistic nephew. She's able to communicate. I mean, there's so many great benefits that she's had from that that don't address majority of your concerns. And so I guess my question to you would be, do we not give a student an opportunity to speak in the coding world simply because it doesn't fit in our box, but yet we look at sign language and it technically didn't fit in our box either, but it has reached many, many students and has been very fulfilling for them? And I guess I look at it as a view of opportunity for students, and we should be looking at ways to provide a diverse amount of opportunity. Do you not agree?
Madam Chair, Representative DeFac, I certainly agree that, like I said, computer coding is essential and important. What we believe is that it is simply not a language in the way that the American Council for the Teaching of Foreign Languages defines a language. And so here we have a governing body of language and linguistics experts, and we even have the computer science faculty at Oregon State agree with us. I mean, that's one of the few cases where professors in the humanities and the sciences agree on one thing, and that is that computer coding is not one of these languages that we would like to see. I think students can benefit from taking a language and a language that can be used to communicate with others, not with machines, but with people.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Representative McLean.
Thank you. My understanding from both speakers was that you would not have a problem with this being offered as a language in high school if it wasn't to fulfill a requirement for your programs. Is that true?
I think that's a separate question. The bill as it's written does allow for this to be counted in community colleges. And so we would need to go back to our faculty, and just as Oregon State has, these are not decisions that the administration makes by themselves in a university. Universities, their curriculum is very bottom up and not very top down. Mm-hmm. And so we would need to go back and check and say, if it were limited to the 2 years in high school, how would you feel about it then? And I think our faculty would want to then weigh in with some K-12 experts. And so for Portland State, I don't know.
So my understanding is that you really would not be able to support this in its present state.
No. Right now, I think the bill's a little probably broader written, and that happens. Everyone knows. It comes back from the Legislative Council, not exactly as one intended. And so I think we would just need to do what the sponsor of the bill's intent is to have an amendment that does make sure that it focuses on those two, that the current two-year requirement of foreign language as an admission requirement. So,
okay.
But we don't speak for Oregon State anymore, so.
Thank you.
You try not to, right?
You're all separate. Yeah.
Okay. We're all independent now.
Yeah. Even as an admission requirement, like I said, we all agree that this is not a world language. So we believe that our students are deficient in foreign languages or world languages to begin with. So it would be only beneficial to them and for the future careers, even in computer sciences, to take up a world language. And so this bill is something that we oppose in this stage, and also as, you know, were it to be rewritten as to include computer coding as an admission requirement.
Okay. All right, thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize, I had another appointment at the beginning of this hearing, so I might have missed this, but I'm actually getting a little more confused. So my statement is truly just a concern that I have that we're clear with. And having a high school senior myself who's been on a track for college and talks about what he needs to take to get into college, to be accepted at college, I want to make sure that we would be ultra clear, depending on how these amendments would flesh out, that we don't have a high schooler thinking this is a language, it's going to get me into college, apply for college, and the answer is no.
Right.
So I'm just very concerned that that would be well communicated and be very, very clear. I don't even know if we're to the point yet to solidify that, but that's a huge concern that I would have.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, these phones that we have now, you know, when I first found out that I could speak into it and it could develop a text and I could send that text, I started texting a lot. And it wouldn't be inconceivable, and maybe they're even out right now, to where you speak in and American and it comes out in German or Spanish or anything else. Is that already available? So in that, then you can speak into your phone or into a computer, and basically through that computer science, you know, you come out with a different language. So, I mean, I'm seeing this as really kind of tied together.
So if I may answer, Madam Chair. Please. And Representative Barreto. Yes, you're absolutely right. And I use Siri, too, in German and in English, and I think it's wonderful. In fact, one of my fellow faculty members sent his comments using Siri to dictate and to send that email. The question to us is, who's on the other end? Who programs that? These are... these are former students who were proficient in languages other than English, so who took Spanish, Mandarin, Chinese, Arabic, and so on and so forth. And I think this is what we would like to point out, that yes, of course, we all benefit from the technology, but essentially it's the people who need to be proficient in other languages.
Okay, good point.
Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have a question so much as I'm a little horrified ever so often when I take a look at my Android after I've spoken into it to see how it interpreted what I said. Apparently, I'm not the only one. I just wanted to make sure. Thank you. Thank you.
And you articulate very well also, so it's surprising.
You need to start speaking a little more clearly.
I guess. Okay, thank you. Any more questions? Okay, thank you very, very much for testifying. Okay, we have no one else signed up for House Bill 2766. Anyone else want out there want to speak? Okay, if not, I close.
I wasn't really planning to, but I do have something I'd like to say.
Okay, on House Bill 2766.
The one we were just listening to. I've taken.
You need to identify yourself.
Oh,
for the
Rebecca
record.
Roth, and I took Spanish at the Grant High. Evening program for adults.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that really frustrated me was that they hired people who spoke two languages but hadn't a clue how to teach it and didn't know the difficulties between the two languages. So they were hiring people simply based on having two languages. And I didn't feel like I learned anything from the program.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you much. Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2766 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2928. Richard, if you could read it. please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2928 establishes a task force on class, the task force on class sizes, to determine appropriate class sizes for students and classes, to identify methods to reduce class sizes, and determine the cost for methods to reduce class sizes. It declares an emergency effective on passage. It has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and the committee has been asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments, which changes the staffing requirement for the task force from the Department of Education to the Legislative Administration Committee. And that's exciting for us.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. I am really happy to be here today. My name is Susan McLean, and I am the representative from Western Washington County, which is House District Number 29. And I really appreciate being here with you today and with another colleague from our committee. And we are here to talk about House Bill 2928, which is to establish a task force on class sizes. The task force will be directed to conduct both grade level and class type specific research to take into account a variety of factors affecting optimal class size. In particular, it's important to understand the impacts of the growing presence of technology in the classroom as it relates to class size. This is a subject of interest and importance, and it would allow schools and teachers to really look at this information to try and figure out what those best practices are in the current times. According to the latest available statistics, Oregon has the third largest class size in the nation. Studies have already shown that having too many students in the classroom is detrimental to student learning. It is critical that we support renewed efforts to improve school learning, such as full-day kindergarten and third-grade reading benchmarks, by providing the very best learning environment possible. The last meaningful review of class size conducted in Oregon was in 2011, and when we looked at that, we found that most of the data was very old. It wasn't from 2011, but it was from 10 years back in some cases. So much has changed in the last several years in the Oregon educational system. Ideally, a new study would be conducted to acquire updated statistics, but for essential knowledge that really can help us make decisions as we're looking to better conditions of education in the state of Oregon, and also making sure that teachers and administrators and folks who are making policy decisions understand truly what class size means to the student, to the teacher, and to the job that the school districts are trying to accomplish. I am not interested in mandating a certain class size or forcing schools to comply with a certain standard. I do not want to encourage the creation of more unfunded mandates. But what I do want to do is make sure that we have current information that can actually be the foundation or the basis for making good decisions in the future, and allowing school districts and administrations and schools to make the same types of decisions that they need to make to carry out other issues. What the point is of this task force is to give power back to the teachers and the administrators and the individuals with good, solid information, and to make sure that we have the most current information. I'm asking you to support House Bill 2928 to establish this task force on class size in Oregon to ensure that every student has an opportunity for the very best class situation to do that learning. Lastly, I do, as the administrator pointed out, have an amendment, and it's on OLIS, and it also, I believe, is in front of you, and there's some in the back. And this simply makes sure that we're not having a large cost to this endeavor, but we will have very adequate and professional staffing by the Legislative Committee Services. And so I ask you, please, to support House Bill 2928, and we'll be happy to answer questions after the next presentation.
Thank you. Senator Peluso.
Good afternoon, Chair Daugherty and fellow members of the Education Committee. I am, for the record, my name is Carla Peluso. I am the representative from House District 50, the great city of Gresham, and also a part of Southeast Portland. I do want to make note, this is my first opportunity to give public testimony as a member of the House of Representatives, so I am jazzed, and to be here, I'm also jazzed to be part of this committee, and equally jazzed to support House Bill 2928, and I got to tell you, the view is very different from this side of the deal. I'm here today along with my colleague, Representative Susan McLean, to ask for your support of House Bill 2928. This bill would establish a task force to address and identify solutions to excessively large class sizes in our schools across the state. As many of you know, I am a member of the Gresham-Barlow School Board, where I am serving my second term. During my time on this board, this issue has increasingly become the cause of stress not only on our school administrations and budgets, our educators and classified staff, but also the educational experience and success of the students we serve. Oregon has good reason to take the time and take a closer look at class sizes in our state. Oregon currently has the third largest class sizes in the nation. Class sizes in Oregon's elementary schools has risen 20% and in our high schools nearly 29% just between the years of 2009 and 2011 alone. Within the Tri-County area, in Gresham, North Clackamas, Beaverton, and Hillsboro, most elementary students were assigned to classes with 29 students or more in 2013. So why such an emphasis on class sizes? In a research study done by the U.S. Department of Education, they concluded that reducing class sizes is one of the few proven, evidence-based reforms that increase student achievement. When there are fewer students to a classroom, we increase the likelihood of success for both our teachers and our students. Small classes decrease strain on our educators, making it more likely for school districts to attract and retain excellent teachers. In the Gresham-Barlow School District, we are seeing an increasing number of teachers transferring to other districts, many who have taught in our district for years because they are being worn out by large class sizes. Although the legislature is working to reverse the trend of disinvestment in education, there is no hiding from the fact that the class sizes in Oregon are too high. Whether we hear from parents at school board meetings, from my conversations over the summer with constituents, or from community members that have spoken to me in events in my district, there is no education issue of greater importance to families in my district than reducing class sizes. I would suspect that rings true for many of my colleagues here today as well. The Gresham-Barlow School District motto is, "Every student prepared for success." I am here today because I believe we should make that promise to every child in Oregon. This bill takes an important step forward in fulfilling that promise. I urge you to support House Bill 2928. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions of our esteemed panelist?
I do.
So good? Okay. Representative Bruno, there's always.
You know that you have no stronger supporter than I am for what you're doing. I'll remind you that I was a classroom teacher at David Douglas while my wife was on the school board there. So I was seeing the class sizes increase every year, and my wife would come home, was a very strong woman, as you know, and sobbing because she would have to cut the budget year after year. So knowing that, you know, we already know how important this is. And we have a quality education model that says that the legislature is supposed to fund us up to a much more appropriate level than what we have now. And I want to say this without sounding snarky, because I'm not. I'm really supportive. What is the point? What would this tell us that we don't know?
I appreciate Representative Reardon. I appreciate the actual sentiment of your question. And I thought long and hard before I put this in front of you for that very reason. And the reason is because the public says it's not being addressed. The public, when I walked for the last 5 to 7 months, door to door, there wasn't one single topic that was more apparent as the number one topic on the door on class size. Why aren't you dealing with class size? And even if it's only perception, I think it's extremely important that they see that there is a task force in 2015 and 16 that actually is looking at the new information, the new data, the new statics, statistics that really indicate why class size is important or not, how it relates to technology or not. What are some of the best practices that are showing that a particular age group and a particular size of class needs to happen if you want the best results? And I don't think that this is empty action. I will also tell you that after 42 years of teaching and retiring in June, that I, as a personal teacher, believe that this investment in this task force is important for not just the parents and the students, but also for the teachers that have been facing it. In the last 5 years, I had more difficulty because of the size of classes. I knew the curriculum. I was an experienced teacher. I knew how to do three different levels of students, or four or five or six levels of students in every class. But I had to cut down, I had to shorten, I had to drop curriculum, and I know what the experience was for the student and the teacher. So I believe that the reason for it, and I don't think your question was snarky, I feel that the reason for it is because, number one, there's new information out there, there's new conditions out there, and there is an expectation by our teachers, by our parents, and as voices for our students that say, we want to look at it again, and we want the information to be the most updated.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to hear.
Okay. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Representative McLean, could you give me additional description on the problem with large class sizes?
I would be happy to do that. I'm going to give you an example of a class that I had that had 42 students in it, and those 42 students were in a speech and a debate class. And I try to make sure that every student is speaking every week, and that major assignments happen at least four times in 9 weeks. And when I had those 42 students, they only got to speak in front of the class half of the time. The other half, I had to have a senior speaker go in the back and tape them, and then take those 22 speeches home and review them at home. Then I'd switch the other half of the class to the front, put the other ones in the back to do one-on-one videotaping, and so they didn't get the same experience. And they didn't get the same interaction or the same immediate feedback from the teacher. That's just one example.
All right.
I can go on.
Well, and I might want to add, because I was a teacher for 10 years, and I only had two English classes. And we had back in the time, like school remembers, you're going to shudder over this one, we had class size in our contract, okay, because it was a permissive subject of bargaining. And so I only had 50 kids, and it would take me all day Sunday, 8 hours or more, to correct papers and to give feedback and this kind of thing for the students to become better writers and so on. And that was with 50 students, and now they're facing 250. And so I shudder to think, in an English class, and I would read things in the paper of, well, the writing scores are going down. I go, oh, really? And the reason would be is that you can't give the feedback and have the kids write the paper again and go through. I mean, I was one of these old-fashioned, they got a misspelled word, they had to write it out 10 times. And this was in high school. And so they just don't have the time to do that kind of thing, not only on that kind of a level, but on a personal level. We used to be able to go through and see that, even at the high school, you know, something's wrong with Johnny this period. He just, something wrong with him. And we would go to Johnny and say, you know, what's wrong? And now there's so many kids, we don't have that, unfortunately, that ability to do it again. So.
Could I give one more?
Please. And
then this one is the one that I think stuck with me the most. About 3 years ago, and it could have been three or four now, you know how it kind of fades together. But I had a student who had some brain damage and only had memory for 2 minutes. And so she needed to sit right up by where I was and take my notes as I was, you know, dealing with instruction so that she could have those to remember. I also had 12 individual IEPs, and I had 2 to 3 autistic students in there, 3 over a 2-semester period. And teachers need to get around to each one of those students and really relate to those needs. And so I think the larger classes just allows the teacher not to use best practices that they know they need to use to make sure that every student is getting as much time, energy, support, and focus as they need in the classroom.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, you know, I actually, before Representative Reardon asked that question, I had kind of exact same question. I would not have asked it as snarky as he did. However, I think we know the there's a problem, and as Representative Reardon said, there's a problem with funding smaller schools too. But when I was over in LeGrand last time, I spoke to a couple of eighth grade classes, and they had volunteers in the class, parents, that were retired, and then one other gal that was the wife of someone on the school board. And I don't know exactly how well they or we utilize volunteer help, but last week in this committee we had people that were volunteering to teach children to read and being quite fulfilled at having that opportunity. And I'm just wondering if this isn't a direction that we should go, is looking for more qualified volunteers that can help out in a situation like that, that can help out in grading the papers, that can help out in the classroom. So anyway, that's just kind of what I was thinking as you were saying this.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could address this, or at least what my thoughts. What has compelled me to support this bill is the creation of that task force that's been mentioned. And just as we heard about from the investment board a conversation earlier, it's bringing some different people and different voices to the table. And I think, Representative Beretta, you set a perfect example that could be a result of a conversation of engaged individuals who want to find solutions and options that just may not have risen to the surface yet, or may not, if they have, may not have been paid close enough attention to. So it's to have that respectful, thoughtful conversation and trying to look at different opportunities. I mean, the main focus of this bill is the forming of that task force to come up with those solutions. And I believe with every new generation, whether it's people sitting at this dais, we bring new creative thoughts to the table, we'll find those solutions.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. The other two people we have signed up, John Hayes and Lori Wimmer. Don't be stupid. Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chairs Springer and Frederick, members of the Education Committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you about establishing a task force on class size. I represent the Forest Grove School District. I'm the chair of the board there. It includes not only Forest Grove, but most of Cornelius. It was my pleasure to serve on the school funding task force this last year as well, and I've gotten some statistics from having served on that committee that I'll talk about in just a second. There are probably more recent statistics than these, but this is what I have. So, as school boards, our mission really is to provide the best education that we can for all students and not to allow students to fall through the cracks. And unfortunately, with the Great Recession and what's happened to the economy in the interim and what's happened to school funding, lots more students are falling through the cracks simply because, as Representative McLean explained from her experience and as a teacher, class sizes are just too large. And so I'm particularly interested in this task force because I've had experience with one of them in the past recently. And in addition to that, I believe that it's one more step towards our understanding what really needs to be done to educate all the students in Oregon. I've looked at the statistics for districts that have more than 1,000 students, and it's not that I don't care about the other districts. Obviously, I do. It's just that once you have, if small districts, class size fluctuates all over the place on an annual basis. And so if you look at the data for those districts, it's not sort of uniform across the spectrum. But if you look at the ones that have at least 1,000 students, and that represents 93% of the students in the state, you find out that in K through 5, from 2008 to 2013, K through 5 only, class sizes increased only by 2.2 students on average, which I think is remarkable. And what I think that means, and it could have gotten worse since then, but I think what that means is that school boards recognize the critical need to have small class sizes to get kids started on the right track. And all of the research that I've read and that others have read and talked about indicates that those class sizes really ideally should be 20 or less. And we're way above that. We're up at 25 in 2013. My understanding is that that's slightly larger now. I don't know what it is, but certainly the Department of Education could tell you what that is. However, there's also research out there that shows that to maintain the progress that's gained by third grade, particularly with reading and so forth, that it's critical to have smaller class sizes throughout. And I'll just give an instance of what happens in fourth grade Cornelius. Our K through, not K through 5, the statistics that I just quoted were K through 5 because that's what ODE had available. But for K through 4, K through 4 is 27 in Forest Grove. Middle school is at 35. And in the core classes in the high school, they're at 40. And these are large increases at the middle school and high school because we didn't want to cut the teachers in the K through 4, and we cut the teachers in middle school and high school. We also cut one-third of the administrative staff in the district, one-third. One out of every three jobs at the administrative level was cut. We cut out foreign languages. We cut out a lot of the career and technical education programs. We cut. It was a disaster and still remains that. Yet the school board and the administration and the teachers are committed to the Common Core state standards. They're committed to helping the students do well on the smarter balanced assessments. They're committed to adopting the next generation science standards. They're committed to the 40-40-20 goals of the state. We want to have all of our students graduate from high school. And we will do everything that we can. But in our district, which has about a two-thirds poverty rate for the students, it's really hard because there are lots of challenges other than just teaching students in the classroom. And we don't want those students who come from poverty in particular to be falling through the cracks. But unfortunately, they are, and particularly when they get to middle school and beyond. And so, in summary, basically, I see this task force as the next step in gathering all the data that we can put out there so that legislators know, parents know, everyone in the state knows what the challenges are, what possible solutions are, and what we need to go forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we've got two more speakers, so if we could continue.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Madam Chair and committee members for your record. Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 42,000 members, two of whom couldn't be here today but did send in some written testimony that I have that you have in your system. And representing them because OEA has had a keen interest in this. Our members have had a class size campaign underway for a couple years now. Our members wearing buttons that say what their average class size is. And we're working very hard on that piece. We know that a class size appropriateness is translates to educational appropriateness and achievement for our students. And so we want to bring down those numbers. And so in past sessions, we have explored the idea of class size as a mandatory subject of bargaining. We've explored class size caps. And just in 2013, we were very pleased to be able to succeed in passing House Bill 2644, which for the first time in the first state ever will ensure that we have an actual and accurate count of every student-to-teacher ratio for all core classes in Oregon. And that should be live on the website, I'm told by the department, next spring. So I'm very excited about that. And then we will really have up-to-date data as a fundamental piece of information for this task as you spotlight the topic. Oregon's dramatically overcrowded classrooms, as you've heard, are known to us because parents and teachers report them anecdotally. They're concerned about students in grade schools who are overwhelmed and act out. They are concerned that providing individual attention has become impossible. They're concerned that grading and commenting on English papers, as our chair has said, is a thing of the past. And they're worried about the students too intimidated by the huge class sizes. And I got this from a radio news report recently, that they were too intimidated by a huge biology class when they didn't understand something to raise their hand and ask. So they're worried about student safety as well. There are a number of issues around class size that really do impede and impair students as they travel throughout the grades from kindergarten all the way through their senior year in high school. And because of the complexity of the subject, perhaps it's best to consider the who, what, where, when, and how of class size. And I have given you my written testimony for the sake of brevity. I won't go through the whole of it, but I would like to point out just a few highlights.
Please.
One is that the quality education model, which was mentioned before, does and has considered what appropriate class sizes are. They've done reviews of the literature. They know what the optimal class sizes are according to experts, and they have just recently updated that in their 2014 report. So that's something that's accessible to this task force and to all of you as you move forward. It's also true that class size as a term means different things to different people, and researchers have made a point of saying that you need to understand that it's not just a multiplier of how many adults are divided into how many total students, and that's your class size. You really have to think about the number of students assigned to a teacher of record, a certified teacher of record, and that's your real class size. And so those are the numbers that we're trying to collect now. And finally, the way you do class size reduction once it comes to that is important. In California, for example, they did what they consider to be a more politicized way. Anyone with a pulse was put in a classroom with students, sometimes in storage closets, not classrooms, and that was considered a class size reduction plan. Whereas in Tennessee, where they had a very research-based sound STARS program, it was called, Charles Achille ran that, they did a very targeted one for students who are high-risk populations, low-income, early grades especially, and for 4 years to ameliorate the fade-out effect, and they got much better results. So these are some of the examples of the kinds of details that might be explored in this task force as you move forward. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions if you should have them, and I look forward to, on behalf of this organization, being of assistance as this moves forward.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much.
You.
Okay, the next two, we've got Rebecca Roth and Tim Cowan. And we're kind of looking at time. We still have quite a few things that we need to get through before 2:45.
Oh, are you going first?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
My name is Rebecca Roth, and I'm here as a concerned parent, and I had seven children. I was told by a teacher along the way that the ideal class size is 1:1. As a homeschooler, I can verify that. I experienced some of my kids went through different classes in the public schools, and then we also homeschooled. And along the way, the Democrats put into place outcome-based education, which came with a warning from Sweden that outcome-based education was going to, or had already in Sweden, destroyed their school system. And in, even so, it was still put into place in Oregon. So number one is where the class size is not necessarily the point here, because when the outcome-based education was put into place in Oregon, it was called the 21st Century Act. Hopefully this doesn't last for a whole 21st century. When the outcome-based education was put into place, the students of Oregon sued the state of Oregon for lack of education.
We need to be talking about the class size, please.
Just a minute. I'm going to sue the state of Oregon for lack of education, and the state of Oregon dismissed it. So I don't think the task force is going to discover anything new that I haven't already discovered by having seven kids in the school system. And I volunteered at Grant, and one of the things I saw was that the class sizes were full of kids that don't speak English because their parents have come over the border illegally, and that the classes are full of kids from other countries. There is no amount of money that we can spend, and there's no task force that will ever say it, but the classes are full of kids from other countries. And I just helped defeat the driver's licenses for illegals that the Democrats passed last time. So I know that the Democrats are committed to these illegals coming into here and living like they're citizens.
We're going to have to stay with the topic.
This is a problem where we the citizens, our monies are being diluted, and now you want to go and spend more money on a task force. And when you took the $250 million out of the education system and put it over into the health care, that's another problem.
problem. As a parent, I am disgusted with the way our school system is.
I'm just sorry. You need to be relevant to the issue, please.
The problem. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Chair and committee members, for the record, Tim Cowan.
And you don't have to be so close to the mic. It'll pick you up.
I just have some information for the task force, and I'll do it real quick. If you take a look at southlakechurch.com, we entered into a partnership with Roosevelt High School, St. John's Community, and Roosevelt High School, after 6 years of working with them, had the highest improvement in graduation rates, and it cost the state nothing. Well, here's the update. We've now went into Michigan, Detroit, Michigan. They had about 15,000 volunteers, and they worked on the school and the neighborhood, a lot of the homes, and remodeled. What happens is we just have a format that you can use. And now we went to the Department of Education, and they're going to pick the top, the first 100 schools that adopt the program and have a national ceremony. So if you'll just go take a look at that, there may be some template that might help.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for testifying. Okay, I've got no one else signed up for 2928. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2928 and open up a work session on House Bill 2404. Richard?
Thank you.
Fresh our old memories.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2404 adjusts school food and beverage nutritional standards to comply with federal food and beverage nutritional standards, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015. The committee has been asked to consider the Dash 1 amendments, which would add seed butters to the list of exempted items, exempted from saturated fat and fat prohibitions. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Do we have to Before we discuss it, do we need to have a motion for it?
Chair Daugherty.
Yeah.
I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2404, dated February 4th, 2015.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2404, dated February 4th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Representative Reardon.
Did we take care of the caffeine for teachers amendment?
Yeah, it was not an amendment, but it was one of these things that this only deals with the children in the building.
As long as that's clear, then I can support this.
Yes, because we do not want the teachers in David Douglas to... Yeah.
Or elsewhere,
that's true.
Especially when they have to deal with large class sizes.
Yes, I do believe that the caffeine issue is not an issue. But right. thank you for following up with that. Okay, is there any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there any objection to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Daugherty, I move House Bill 2404 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2404 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Brito.
Madam Chair, does that mean that Dash 2 is null and void then?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other? Okay. Seeing none, will the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative
Brown.
Aye.
Representative
Hatt.
Aye.
Representative
McCoy.
Aye.
Representative
Pinzo. Absent. Or excused,
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Gordy?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Do we have someone that would like to carry this on the floor?
I will if nobody wants to.
Okay, thank you. Representative McLean will carry this on the floor. Okay. So I close the work session on House Bill 2404 and open up a work session on House Bill 2650. Richard, if you could jog our memories.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2650 directs the State Library to distribute grants to school districts for early reading programs provided during the summer. It declares an emergency effective on passage. The there has been a fiscal statement issued and a revenue light statement issued. The Office of the Speaker has asked that the measure go to Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Is there any discussion on House Bill 2650?
A motion.
Oh, excuse me. Maybe we could have a motion on it.
Oh, okay.
Maybe we could do that first. Thank you, Representative Springer.
Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 2650 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2650 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Okay.
I have a discussion. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill does not have a sunset on it, and it seems to be kind of an experimental type of program, so that's a little concern of mine.
Well, I think with this, what there are is they're just updating the Oregon state regulations to go along with the federal regulations.
Okay.
It's not a new program. It's the same. It's the same thing with the feds go through and update their nutrition standards, and the state of Oregon is just adhering to those.
Right, but it says it further expands.
That's 2602. You're talking about 2650.
Oh, 50.
Library.
Library, yeah.
I'm
still on nut seeds.
Yeah, right.
It's the library grant program.
Yes, there is not, Ms. Okay. Barreto. It is not a federal program, by the way, on nutrition. So. Okay. Yeah, and this is one of these things. Every biennium, it has to be funded. So I guess it doesn't have a sunset written in, but it does if no money is allocated next biennium. Follow up, or now that I've got the right bill?
I'm processing. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out the fiscal impact statement that we have on OLIS. A couple things I just want to make note of. I will be supporting this bill. But first of all, it's talking about this being implemented through the Oregon State Library, and there is conversation here in the fiscal statement that there's a chance that there could be, that they will need to add a half-time program analyst one position at a cost of $99,918. And there is the potential, if I'm understanding this correctly, in the bottom, in implementing the program, there could also be an additional half FTE research analyst for position at a cost of $103,288,000. So potentially we're looking not at the cost that is put into the program, but the cost to implement the program, staff the program, is potentially $203,206. I just wanted on record that I sure hope we can do this for the half-time that is initially requested in here and not the additional half-time.
Okay, and that's noted for the record because that will be dealt with in the Ways and Means Committee. But
I happen to be there.
Then I think you will bring it up again.
I will.
Thank you very much. Okay, any other discussion?
Yeah, Chair Doherty.
Yes.
You said no sunset, but they have to reevaluate this every biennium. Does that come up kind of like a red flag, you know, that this is funded? Or how does that – I haven't worked on the other side. So when this comes up for funding, how do they look at that?
Yeah. Usually every program has to come up every 2 years for funding issues unless there's some sort of clause in it that it goes on forever and ever. Literally every program is up every 2 years.
Is there anyone that has to basically defend the program, you know, or evaluate it and say this worked, this didn't work, this is good, this is bad?
I think our Ways and Means person could get a little more insight into that.
Just to offer up, so I can make in 2011 when I co-chaired that committee, I brought up there was a particular program, I'm not going to mention it, in the larger education budget. And I didn't know what the program was about. And I said, what's that about? And got a couple explanations, and those weren't satisfactory to me. I didn't yet understand the scope of the program. And so it was only then that a whole bunch of people came and defended that program, which was a good thing, and I learned more about it. So the reason I say that is, yes, in theory, every 2 years, if somebody talks about it, So I would maybe recommend that you and I chat about that, and that's something that, assuming I continue on the Ways and Means Ed Sub like I have for quite a few sessions now, continue to discuss this and see where it's at, if we're getting results for, mm-hmm. for the money that's being spent, and then prioritizing those dollars. Does that answer your question, kind of? It's not a clean little answer, unfortunately.
No, it wasn't bad.
Thank you, sir.
Just the open discussion.
At least I'm not snarky.
Just the open discussion would be good, and especially before we voted. But, you know, if we have to vote today, then I would probably be a no vote, and I may change it between now and, you know, when it hits the floor. But mm-hmm. I wouldn't feel good about just doing that right now.
Okay.
So.
That's your point. Thank you very much. Representative McLean.
The other question that I had, I'm very supportive of the program, and I thought we got some good reasons on why it had been successful and how this sort of extends it and carries it forward. But it's the coordination issues. There's coordination between the State Library and the Department of Ed. There's coordinations between, you know, on some of these programs, you know, the free and reduced lunch or, you know, have lunch and read. And so there's a lot of coordination issues. And remember I asked for a flow chart or something that would help us see how this kind of falls out, who's in charge of what and how they relate to each other. And I think that as our representative on the Ways and Means, Representative Springer, goes forward, that also is really a financial, you know, concern in my mind, that you would try and figure out, you know, how the budget's being used and how that coordination is actually happening when you have maybe budget from two or three different programs. So I really support this. I think it's important, but I think it's important for us also to try and figure out what is the flow chart on both funding and, mm-hmm. you know, explicit program elements.
Because mm-hmm. I know that the programs have worked together, and yeah. especially with early learning reading. And so, but I think that's a good comment, and I'm sure that Representative Springer will deal with it.
Deal with it, yes.
No, she will. She will investigate it and bring it up to the Ways and Means Committee. Okay, any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Hack?
Yes.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Representative Paluzzo?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Barreto?
No.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Gordon?
Aye. Okay, the motion passes and the bill will be sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Okay, do we want to do that at the end?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, if you want to let her know. Okay, with that, I close the work session on House Bill 2650 and open up a work session on House Bill 2602.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2602 modifies the criteria to qualify for grants to be used to provide instructional time during the summer programs. It sunsets the grant program on June 30th, 2017. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015. This measure also has a request from the Office of the Speaker to go to Ways and Means, so a fiscal light statement has been issued.
Okay. There's a motion to discuss it.
That's what we're going to do.
Get a motion that will discuss it.
Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 2602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that be referred to Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Representative McLean.
We heard a lot that day, and the three presentations just kind of, you know, flowed together. And so I may have missed this, and so maybe somebody else can remind me. Where does the $1 million for these grants come from?
I can't remember. Do you remember?
General fund.
Is it all general fund? Because I, you know, and what I didn't understand, they had $500,000 this year. So who made the decision that we're going from 500 or from this last year, that we were going from 500,000 to 1 million?
I believe it was a biennium. That's a biennial.
That what it was. So it's 5,000 to 5,000.
Okay.
There was no increase.
And so the money that
we
was,
always have to start thinking 2 years yeah. instead of one.
So the money that was left on the table is just added back in, because they talked about money being left on the table. Do you remember that discussion?
I did get clarification yep. on that.
Okay.
They did utilize all the funds.
They did.
There was no money left on the table. Even though they didn't have all the schools come to the table, they did utilize all the dollars.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
Did you say that again, Joe? I didn't hear you.
When I had asked the question, the fact that they had not gotten 100% participation from all of the title schools, and so I'd asked, you know, what they did with the money left on the table, and they did get back to me and said that they had utilized all of the funding for those schools. So.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification for getting that. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess you can tell I'm the Ways and Means person because I focus in on the fiscal impact statements. I just had two superintendents not from my district in my office today, and they were talking about the education budget that's slated to potentially be at $7.235 billion and talked about the need of $7.5 billion. Again, I support this, and there'll be further discussion down in Ways and Means. Every dollar we spend on programs like this, which are great programs, are dollars that aren't in
K-12.
The K-12 budget. So I just want us to all be aware that mm-hmm. it's money that could go there or someplace else. And so I put that on the record as schools are coming to me advocating for 7.5. I'm not saying feeding is not important mm-hmm. and reading is very important. But these are dollars we're making choices with.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other discussion? Okay, hearing none. Oh, excuse me, Representative Hack.
You know, and I want to reiterate the same as Representative Springer, that these are difficult choices to make, and while they're deserving programs, you do struggle with that. I too am struggling with the same thought.
Yeah. Well, so this is where, I mean, being a policy committee, that's the good thing that we don't have to. We look at the policy, mm-hmm. and then Ways and Means looks at the financial burden. Okay. Any more discussion?
Well, do you do vote explanations here? I'm going to vote yes, but I want to make sure that people understand that because it was a two-year program. It was a two-year budgeted program, right? And so the support from last time, it was a program that's being carried forward. But I also agree that a lot of the school superintendents today have talked about siloed money and unsiloed money. Mm-hmm. And so if we're going to get to 7.5 or 7.8 or whatever, and I heard 7.8 today was necessary just to keep it at today's dollar for today's cost. And so I do also think that it's important for us to look at the bang for the dollar and making sure that we are getting what we need in the right place for this year's budget.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Barreto, we're going to have to move along. We still have one other piece of business to do.
I'm not sure this is germane to this. It has to do with the dollars, and it had to do with our meeting in caucus today with the budget people.
But okay, so that may be another.
Yeah.
Okay, any other discussion? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah, I just have to serve notice to no one in particular that it's getting to the end of the line for me on the extras here, mm-hmm. because we know what we have to do with the K-12 budget in total, and the little things that we're doing here are nice, and I agree with them, but there does come a time when we have to concentrate on the larger overarching goal here.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Will the clerk roll call the roll, please?
Representative McLean.
Yes.
Representative Paluzzo.
Yes.
Representative Reardon.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Barreto.
No.
Representative Hack.
Yes.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, well, that motion passes, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2602, and we have one other order of business, which is Representative Paluzzo. We voted on one of these when you were gone, mm-hmm. and so we're going to give you the opportunity, and Representative Frederick.
Yes, Chair Doherty, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Paluzzo to vote on House Bill 2404 as amended. It will not change the outcome of the vote.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Frederick moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Paluzzo to vote on House Bill 2404 as amended. It will not change the outcome of the vote. The motion is not debatable. Is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, the motion carries and the rules have been suspended. Representative Paluzzo, how do you vote?
with my thanks, I vote yes.
Okay, thank you very much. So we close the work session. I think that's it for today. Anything else for the good of the order? Okay, we're out of here. We adjourn.